In the meantime, from me, Chris Smith, thanks for listening, and goodbye.
Good morning, and hello, hope you're doing okay. Sunday morning, it's Five Live Breakfast, it's me, Chris Warburton,
and me, Bliss Hannah, good morning, good to be with you.
Mm-hmm, so we've got a lot to talk about, Labour conference, we're going to be talking about the match, Manchester City against Arsenal, of course, which you can hear live on Five Live as we approach 7 o'clock.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
And the news headlines. The British boxer Daniel Dubois has retained his IBF World Heavyweight title with a fifth round knockdown of two-time former unified champion Anthony Joshua. James Gregg will bring us all the latest on that fight in the Sport Bulletin shortly.
But first, Sir Keir Starmer says it is his job to do something about leaks coming from the government after the salary of his chief advisor Sue Gray was made public earlier this week. He was speaking to The Observer ahead of the start of the Labour Party conference. The PM said leaks damage everybody and that it was his responsibility to solve the problem. Alex Forsyth is our political correspondent.
Because of the week that the party's had, this week we've had all of that drip, drip constantly of stories about, you know, the gifts of clothing, the gifts of spectacles, the tickets to the football matches, the pay of Sue Gray. I think that has just set quite a difficult tone going into this conference. And there's like a consciousness that they need to find a way to deal with that so that they can get on with talking about what it is that they want to, which is what Labour plans to do in government.
The Crown Prosecution Service says it twice failed to bring charges against the former owner of Harrods, Mohammed Al-Fayed. Fresh allegations are being made about the late billionaire, sparked by dozens of women coming forward to say they were raped or sexually assaulted by him. Nick Johnson reports.
In 2009, the Crown Prosecution Service was handed a file of evidence by police who'd investigated claims that Mr. Al-Fayed had sexually assaulted a 15-year-old girl in the boardroom at Harrods. The CPS declined to bring charges. Now, as first reported by the Sunday Times, it's been confirmed the CPS also decided in 2015 not to prosecute the billionaire after reviewing an allegation of rape. In a statement, the CPS said that in both cases, it did not feel confident there was a realistic prospect of conviction.
The Iranian-backed group Hezbollah says it has launched rockets at an Israeli military complex in the northern city of Haifa in an initial response to the targeting of communication devices in Lebanon last week. 39 people were killed and thousands of others were wounded when their pagers and walkie-talkies exploded. Hezbollah has blamed the attacks on Israel, which hasn't commented. The Israeli army says more than 100 rockets were fired from Lebanon.
And Donald Trump has declined to take part in a second US presidential debate with his Democratic rival Kamala Harris ahead of November's election. Ms. Harris has accepted an invitation from CNN to hold another debate with Mr. Trump, but he told a rally in North Carolina it was too late.
James Gregg is here. Good morning.
Good morning.
And, well, Anthony Joshua, he was, you know, knocked all over the place last night, wasn't he?
He was, yeah. I thought you were going to ask me about the game of the day, actually, before we got onto that.
I know you were at what you were calling the game of the day.
Yeah, well, it wasn't just me, though, actually, was it? Because Mark Clement was on Five Live Sport yesterday, and he also reckoned it was the place to be.
Oh, right.
I suppose Sheffield United is the one. That's the game of the day for me. Sheffield United against Derby County.
Yeah, and you hear Chappers there going, vociferously.
But he's a Football League guy, isn't he?
He is, Mark Clement, yeah.
But that's fair enough.
Yeah.
Did it live up to the hype?
It was all right. It was good.
It was all right.
It was good, yeah.
Doesn't feel like game of the day.
I had my pie, had my Bovril. Bit too warm for Bovril yesterday.
Bit too much.
What kind of pie?
It was chicken balti pie.
Oh, yeah,
chicken
winner.
Balti pie.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Bit offensive to those sat near you, but, you know.
No, they do a good chicken balti pie down at Stockport County as well, actually.
Yeah, it's good.
It's the world we're in, isn't it? You know, for football pies these days. But fantastic, love it.
Laced with Henderson's relish as well.
Oh, yes.
There you go.
Yes. Yeah, but the fight.
The fight, absolutely fantastic. You know what? Boxing on the radio. Mm. And I know that when we do the golf or when Wimbledon's on, we get a lot of messages in here at Five Live and, you know, personally and all that. And people say, God, isn't it so good, you know, listening to the golf on the radio or whatever. I think boxing on the radio, you know, for somebody who doesn't know that much about boxing, I think it's a great way to consume it. And I know we're biased here, obviously.
No, but you're right. And I think back, and I'm going to date myself a bit here, but I remember when Frank Bruno fought Mike Tyson.
Wow. Okay.
And it was, I only listened to it on the radio, and I must have been, I'll have to look up the date. I'll look up the date when you're doing the bulletin, but I was a kid, like, you know, and I remember just listening to that in bed and it just being such an evocative Amazing. Thing, you know what I mean? Because it was the only way I could possibly follow it then.
And the thing is now you've got pay-per-view and all this kind of stuff. Actually, I think, you know, why not listen to it for free?
Yeah.
You know, it's absolutely brilliant. So it was great. And look, you know, there was 96,000 fans. I know we talked a lot about that yesterday. That really came through, I thought, you know, in terms of the sheer atmosphere. It was brilliant. And Daniel Dubois would dismantle Anthony Joshua, didn't he? Five rounds, and basically catapults himself into kind of global sporting stardom, really, because there's a lot of interest across the pond. Obviously, he might get some fights in America and all the riches that come with that as well. And many questions, of course, I'm sure, surrounding the future for Anthony Joshua. We'll be hearing from Steve Bunce here on the programme before 8 o'clock. But Dubois now has that biggest win of his 24-fight career. Obviously, a great day in the Premier League as well yesterday. Liverpool went top after that 3-0 win over Brentford. Crystal Palace drew 0-0 against Manchester United. Great win for Chelsea in the early game. They beat West Ham away from home 3-0. Nicholas Jackson with a couple there. And today it's all about the big one, isn't it? Manchester City at home to Arsenal in that late game here on Five Lives Premier League Sunday from 4:30.
1989. So I would have been 13 listening to that. I can still remember. Get in there, Frank. That was the commentary, wasn't it, from Harry Carpenter?
Yeah, that's
when
right.
He gave him a right old go, Bruno. That was fantastic. I mean, there won't be a... You can't imagine there'll be a rematch, will there? I mean, I know that there'll be a rematch clause, but if you were Anthony Joshua and you're looking back at that,
yeah,
and he was put down how many times? Four times last
Five
night?
Times.
Five
yeah.
times.
Yeah.
You'd think, I mean, how's it going to be any different if you did? I mean, I know it's a payday, but he doesn't need a payday.
No, he doesn't. No, that's it, isn't it? I think it's for now, it's probably, you know, what next for him? You know, what suits him now, you know, in terms of having a bit of success to end the career? And
well, I think it makes the path to fury, Joshua, well...
I think that's done now.
Toast.
I mean, that's Buncey, but yeah. I think that's done.
But also kind of less appealing anyway. If he's not the man, I mean, you know, 5 years ago, that was what everybody wanted.
Yeah,
I'm
correct.
Sure there'll still be loads of people in boxing who still do want that, but it hasn't got the same allure, has it?
No,
if he's not the guy at the top.
You're right. If it had happened... I mean, you think pre-COVID.
Yeah.
That'd have felt like humongous, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But this is heavyweight boxing, isn't it? Fascinating, fascinating.
What are you thinking for City Arsenal just before you go? I mean, you kind of want it to be, it's going to be live on Five Live, obviously. We want it to be this, you know, end-to-end stuff, but it's not, is it? It's going to be tactical, and it was 0-0 last time, and you wouldn't better get it to it this time.
I think they have... Arsenal have more injuries to think about, don't they? And actually, already they were slightly depleted. So, I don't know. City are just such a juggernaut. I've not committed to that, and I won't.
Yeah.
but it's going to be a great match.
Gabriel and Saliba have done very well at keeping Haaland quiet.
They have.
In the three games last season that they faced each other. So that'll be interesting, won't it? Anyway, all right, good stuff. And actually, it'll be... Arteta was, we can get into this in a bit, but he said, we're there to win. We're going to go there to win. But he surely would have watched that Inter Milan performance against Manchester City in the week and thought, oh, okay.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
If they can do it.
You know, Parker the bus.
Yes, indeed. All right, James, thank you for now. It's 7:08.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live, the voice of the UK.
Sunday Breakfast. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Good morning, it's Sunday Breakfast with Chris Warburton and Fliss Hannah. Loads to come in the next 3 hours. Loads of sport, loads of politics, loads of news. A bit on CFAX, if you remember that. I'm going to brush up on that later on in the show. Did you use CFAX?
There was a soap opera on CFAX back in the day.
How?
Every day it got updated. It might have been the Oracle, actually, rather than CFAX. But anyway, they were kind of the same thing, weren't they?
Printed story.
Every day there would be a kind of, you'd follow on with the next bit of the story. I mean, it's bizarre to even think of it now, but that was how it was. But, you know, talking about sport, that's where you would get your sporting updates from as well. Anyway, it would have been the 50th anniversary of CFAX today.
It would have.
Even though it doesn't exist anymore.
It was kind of it was a precursor to the internet, wasn't it? So it just sort of developed. Anyway, we'll be talking about that later on in the show. But first of all, Labour's annual conference officially begins in Liverpool later today. today. Now, this, of course, is the party's first conference since they entered government, so first in government for more than a decade. The Deputy PM, Angela Rayner, is today's key speaker. She's expected to announce a series of measures designed to protect renters. She'll also talk about implementing Awab's Law, named, of course, after two-year-old Awab Ishak from Rochdale, who died from a respiratory condition caused by mould in his social housing flat.
It obviously follows a relatively turbulent time for the new government. The criticisms over cuts to winter fuel allowance, of course, scrutiny over the Prime Minister's willingness to accept gifts and hospitality. And we had the leaks at the BBC story about the salary of his top aide, Sue Gray.
So let's get the thoughts of John McTernan, who was Tony Blair's Director of Political Operations from 2005 to 2007 and Senior Advisor at the PR company Burson. John, good morning.
Good morning.
So this is a really interesting conference, isn't it? Because, you know, they're new to power. You feel like this should be just the party after, the, you know, a tough electoral campaign that should be a real feeling of celebration. It doesn't feel like it's going into, you know, going into that in that kind of upbeat spirit. You've been, you know, we've been hit. We've seen a series of scandals for the new government. And of course, they're talking quite a lot of doom and gloom about the economy.
Yeah, look, I don't think anybody ever expected this to be like a celebration because the circumstances Britain is in with its, you know, lost decade and a half of economic growth, the low productivity, the pressures on the public sector, the public suffering from still the effects of the cost of living crisis. I don't think anybody in the country is celebrating apart from the fact of getting rid of the Tory government. And well, in essence, this question is to get down to work, I think. And it's getting down to work and telling the story of what the difference Labour is going to make, like for renters or like for building houses.
Well,
or,
I think,
you know,
there's a few different things to get into that, into yeah. there, isn't there? Let's start off, though, with the fact that we, you know, are seeing the new government going into conference with, they've had criticism over the cuts to the winter fuel allowance. They've, you know, two scandals really already. The scandal of, you know, the Prime Minister accepting freebies, glasses for passes, passes for glasses, it's being called. And the fact you've got that really brutal infighting where people are leaking the chief of staff's salary.
Well, they're not scandals. They're gossip.
They're not scandals. I mean, well, I think people are seeing them as quite scandalous.
They're absolutely. It is not scandalous to make a donation. We have political donations in the country, and I think they're part of the political life is donations, and they're declared. The thing is, Keir declared everything that was donated to him and to his wife. Now that is very different from when Boris Johnson was in Downing Street and you had to drag information out of him. There had to be parliamentary inquiries to find out who gave him his holidays on what terms, whatever. So I think the transparency has been clear. Nobody, you know, the donor to Keir has been a peer for 37 years. So he's doing it to support the Labour Party. He wasn't doing it for any personal gain. I think it's gossip. If it's frost now, Labour should have had a powerful news agenda to push these stories to the margins. It doesn't need it should be page five, page seven stories, not stories that dominate the headlines. I think there's been a communications failure, not filling the airways with the positive Labour stuff.
I mean, you can call it gossip and froth, but it cuts through, doesn't it? So, you know, in terms of those freebies, no rules have been broken. Okay, but the research group More in Common has carried out three focus groups. It shared some of the findings of those focus groups after the headlines that we've seen. And the responses from ordinary people, ordinary voters, ranged, they said, from disappointment to frustration to outrage. I suppose if you come in on a platform of the grown-ups are in the room where, you know, there's no more sleaze, there's no, you know, like if you come in on that mandate, and then you're sort of seen to be taking, I don't know, glasses and dresses and that kind of thing. You can see why the public might think this isn't on.
Look, the thing is, Labour's got a 10-year plan to rebuild the UK because it needs that length of investment to turn around all of the problems in the country. And it's got a 5-year target to have achieved a substantial amount by the time of the next election. And, you know, if we build the houses, if we give renters rights, if we renationalise the railways, if we create British energy, if we get the renewable energy revolution and the jobs in the UK, I think that's what we'll be judged on in the next election, not whether or not people think it's okay to get a donation from a Labour donor, a Labour Party member, for more than 40 years to give money to the Labour Party. I think in the end, no one cares what the salary of somebody who's got a job they didn't know existed and whose name they'd never heard of before. All that's going on in number 10. The issue is, can we make the changes that the country needs? And I think voters are desperate for change and signs of change. And I think so are most Labour Party members. People voted for change. They voted for the public services to be restored. They voted. And we're in this, you know, we're only 9-10 weeks into a Labour government. And so some of the, you know, some of the responsibilities being held to us, like, we can't fix things in 9 weeks.
No.
We'll definitely fix them in some things in 9 months as first legislation has been passed.
You've talked about maybe a communications failure and needing more bold new policies. I was thinking, you know, Tony Blair famously came in with things will only get better. Keir Starmer has come in and said, you know, things are going to get worse before they get better. And we had some really interesting data out, you know, on Friday. So we had the GfK sort of consumer confidence measure. Yeah. And it shows a massive drop in how confident people felt about their finances in September. And I spoke to one boss who said that, you know, traffic to his website to purchase things like appliances was down 9% since Keir Starmer started talking about, you know, there's going to be pain ahead. It's going to be a difficult budget. There's going to be pain in the budget. A lot of people are just, you know, they're feeling quite anxious about their finances. Well, communications error?
No, look, there are things that are fundamentally wrong in Britain and need to be fixed. That's why the Labour Party was swept in with a landslide. You can't change the public mood by a speech from Downing Street.
You can make him feel gloomy. You
literally can't. I don't believe that the Prime Minister has a huge hold over the country. People make up their own minds correctly, and they feel after the 14 years of Tory failure, after the cost of living crisis, after the constraints of COVID, there's been a whole load of things with the war, the war in Ukraine, geopolitical situation. Things are not great. Climate crisis. You know, we're having unusual weather in the UK. In a sense, people are right to think things are difficult. The job this week of Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves and the rest of the cabinet. You know, last year it was the shadow cabinet. This year it's the cabinet. It's not to celebrate, but to say, this is what we're going to do for you. Yes, you have to be realistic with the public, saying things are going to get worse before they get better, but you have to be visionary and optimistic and say, and this is what better looks like. This is what better will be. This is what it's going to mean for you. And for so many people, if Labour deliver, it's the 1.5 million houses we promised to deliver, then they'll say, that's been a change. That changes opportunity for young people. It changes jobs available for people. It changes your neighbourhood. There's a whole number of things we need to get going. And the basic legislation, some of the changes have been made already. And we just have to tell the story all this week. And the red thread going through the whole conference has to be, this is how Labour are going to tackle the issue of inequality. You know, regional inequality. Inequality within the country has got worse in the last 14 years. Labour reversed it under New Labour. Labour can reverse it again under Starmer. But there's got to be some of that hope and optimism and sense of a future that the country has to build together.
And we'll see if some of that starts at the conference this weekend. John McTernan, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's John McTernan, senior advisor at the PR company Burson, formerly of Tony Blair's political operations. It is 17 minutes past seven.
On Radio 4, the more you listen, the more you see.
We're living under more tyranny today than our founding fathers did in 1775.
A US presidential election is looming, but underneath, conspiracy culture rears its head once again. And nothing is as it seems.
All those things that we had feared our whole lives was coming true.
Burn the house down and start over. That seems to be the way.
It's America through the looking glass. Join me, Gabriel Gatehouse, as The Coming Storm continues. Listen on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Right, let's talk about the football. Interesting day in the Premier League yesterday. Interesting listening to 6:06 with Robbie and Chris as well last night. So Solanke scored for Spurs. A great result for Fulham against Newcastle in the end. Villa's turnaround as well. Liverpool in real control yesterday. And actually a solid result for Chelsea against West Ham, who not looking too clever at the moment for them, is it? Premier League Sunday here on 5 Live, though. We'll have commentary from the Etihad this afternoon. Manchester City and Arsenal kicking off at 4:30. Manchester City midfielder Kevin De Bruyne could be involved despite being forced off at half-time against Inter Milan on Wednesday. And Arsenal welcome back Declan Rice to Premier League football after he missed the win over Spurs last weekend due to suspension.
Man City boss Pep Guardiola knows that Arsenal have a formidable defensive record. They've conceded just one goal in the first five games this season, and they haven't lost an away game in 2024.
Saliba and Gabriel, they are incredible focus with just with Erling all the time. So it's not one against one, it's always two against one, sometimes three against one. So that's why it's difficult to attack them. So they didn't, I think in 24, they didn't lose away. It's not just one game or two games. There are many games. They are be solid, consistent in that.
Well, what about the Arsenal boss? Well, Mikel Arteta looking to improve his team's record at the Etihad. They got a draw last season there after, years of heavy defeats.
A really competitive one. We are to the home of the champions, the team that I think in the Premier League history has been the most consistent ever, not only in terms of result, but in terms of dominance. And this is the challenge that we go there and we have to prove that again we have made another step and we can compete and win in those grounds.
Let's speak to a couple of fans. Manchester City fan Joyce Bassingay from the Gold Diggers podcast and Arsenal fan Alan Alger from the Football Istingly Arsenal podcast. Good morning, both.
Good morning.
Good morning. We want this to be a kind of non-stop thrills and spills, end-to-end, top-of-the-table clash, don't we? I wonder if it's going to go that way, Alan. What kind of game are you expecting this afternoon?
Yeah, I mean, I love Mikel Arteta, but I don't believe him when he says that he's going to win the game and play attacking football. I just think circumstance means that Arsenal can't go and do that. Martin Odegaard is a massive miss. I think we saw that in midweek, a pretty dire game in Italy. And I just think that another 0-0 at this stage of the season will be absolutely fine. Some might say that the fact that Arsenal only drew at the Etihad last season was a factor behind obviously not overtaking Manchester City and probably should have gone for it. But that was at the latter stage of the season. At this stage of the season, without Odegaard, and the fact that Arsenal have had a pretty tough beginning, especially some away games where gone to Villa and won, gone to Tottenham and won. I don't think it's any disgrace to get today to go to the Etihad and get a 0-0. So anyone looking for an exciting game,
forget it.
I don't think any Arsenal fans want one.
No, fair enough. Actually, because Rodri said after City secured the title in May that he knew they would emerge victorious when Arsenal came to the Etihad for a draw because they, in his words, lack mentality. But like you say, Arteta has insisted he's going to set up his team to win. We shall see. Seems unlikely, as you suggest. But just staying on the point around Odegaard, as you say, not great against Atalanta, was it? It was a bit of a struggle last weekend as well, wasn't it? And what does that say when you've got a team that begins to lose quite a lot of its creative spark with one player missing?
Yeah, I mean, it's how special that one player is and the fact that everything goes through him. Now, I think a lot of fans of other clubs will say Arsenal were really lucky. And we were last season with injuries. And you've got to expect that some of your key players are going to be missing. And the fact that Declan Rice was out last week meant that, along with Odegaard, had to go and make it a poor game at Tottenham and nick a 1-0. And it was, some people were saying, back to George Graham days. And I don't mind that. I really don't mind that at all. The creative spark needs to be there. It needs to be back there. I think Declan Rice can actually be that creative spark today. A lot of people see him as a midfielder that should play a bit nearer the defence rather than playing sort of balls through to the attack. But I think that all depends on whichever partner Mikel Arteta picks for him today. And Thomas Partey wasn't great in midweek, and I don't think Jorginho was either, but it'll be one of those two.
It's not sort of same kind of flair player, though, is he? But I know what you mean. Okay, Joyce, do you want it to be exciting? Do you expect it to be exciting?
Honestly, I don't think it will be exciting. I think in terms of Arsenal missing or a key player, and obviously we are not 100% sure if KDB will be playing for us either. I'm just not expecting too much. Arsenal's win last weekend to me wasn't too convincing, and then obviously midweek both of us in the Champions League, there wasn't really anything going there, so
no.
I don't exactly know what to expect today. I'd say
go on.
The last two seasons that Arsenal have lost the league to us should haunt them, and I am hoping something will be different and challenge us in a way. Obviously, I was really surprised with this fixture being so early into the season, but hopefully it conjures something different.
Yeah, I mean, they might well go for the low block after what they saw Inter did to you in the week, because clearly City were a little bit kind of ruffled by the way they approached the game, weren't they? Indeed. But Gabriel and Saliba, amazing partnership. Dare I say they have Haaland's number, because they barely allowed him a shot in the three games last season.
I'll let them have that for now. To be quite honest, it's all they've probably got going for them at the moment. So if that's the case, I think we've understood in the last two seasons that we've had Haaland that Haaland is quite literally there to kind of be the main focus. So then we can do the rest of the work. The rest of the players on the pitch can do the rest of the work and push forward. So if that means that Haaland is again heavily marked, I'm assuming there'll be different creative outputs, and obviously if there's no KDB, they'll most likely will be Foden. So,
yeah. Okay. Well, we'll see, won't we? We will see. Enjoy if you can.
We haven't done a great job in selling this, have we?
We're trying to build up all day to the commentary on Five Live, guys. You know, come off it. It will be what it will be, of course. But okay. Thanks for talking to us. Appreciate you getting up for us. Joyce Bassingay, Manchester City fan, and Alan Alger from the Arsenal side of things. So yeah, we will have that commentary for you at 4:30. Alistair Bruce Ball, who will catch up with live on the programme a little bit later on. He'll be with Clinton Morrison for the programme. What else have we got? Well, Colin obviously is going to be joining you from 10 o'clock the build-up was talking to those guys. But he'll have Viv Anderson with him. Kim Little's going to be on the programme. Pat Nevin, of course, Ian Holloway, Lauren Price and Paul Dickoff. Then we'll get into Premier League Sunday from midday. Steve Crossman will be taking you through that and into commentary of Brighton versus Nottingham Forest. That will be happening at 2:00. And then, as I say, Manchester City versus Arsenal at 4:30. It's 25 minutes past 7.
Yeah, and in the Women's Super League, Arsenal also face Man City this afternoon with kickoff at 12:30. Liverpool take on Leicester City. Tottenham Hotspur face Crystal Palace. Let's talk to the former England international, Lindsay Johnson, who's on the line. Lindsay, morning.
Good morning, Felicity.
So how are you feeling? Start of the new season.
Yeah, really excited. Obviously, it started on Friday evening. Chelsea up against Villa. They managed to get a 1-0 win. It wasn't as convincing as everyone thought it would be. Villa really put up a good fight, and that was a good start to the season. Then a couple of games yesterday as well.
Yeah, a bit more convincing yesterday.
Yeah, definitely. You had obviously Manchester United at home at Old Trafford to West Ham. I was at that game, and it was a really convincing win from Manchester United with lots of new signings getting on the pitch, most notably Grace Clinton, who managed to bag a goal as well on her first game back at a club. So it was a really convincing win for Mark Skinner yesterday. So that was a fantastic game.
Yeah, and then also Brighton and Hove Albion, a 4-0 victory over Everton.
Yeah, really strong performance from Brighton. They made some excellent signings in the summer and pre-season in the experienced players of Frank Kirby and Nikita Paris from Manchester United. But it was Japan striker Kiko Sake who got a hat-trick on a debut yesterday. And really, really good performance from then. And Everton just didn't really have an answer for them, which was a disappointing start for them for their WSL season.
Now, I like the human drama in this, and you know, looking ahead to Arsenal, Man City this afternoon. Of course, you've got Viviana Mdama, formerly Arsenal, now playing for City. What do you think that's like?
This is a really interesting story, isn't it? Because Mdama is the WSL all-time goal scorer.
Yeah,
and Arsenal, Jonas Edeval let her go on a free to his rivals in Manchester City, and they lost the league last season to Chelsea on goal difference. And if you need some goals, then signing Viviane Mdama is the answer. So I think that game today is going to be really interesting. Not only is it a heavyweight clash between two of the top teams in the league, but it's really got that added edge because of that Mdama signing as well. So that'd be a fantastic game. With some quality world-class players on show today.
I'll tell you what as well. Morning, by the way, Lindsay. There's some amazing statistics around how many people are turning up to watch Arsenal's home games that I'm just looking at this morning. Last season, the average attendance for their home games was 32,618. It was the highest in the Women's Super League by about 20,000. The 15th highest of any English side, men or women. Taking only their 6 league games at the Emirates, their average is 52,000, and only seven Premier League teams can better that figure, which is pretty remarkable, isn't it? I mean, you know, I suppose they're playing fewer games, which might change the average if it was stretched out longer. And also people will point and say, well, there's cheaper tickets. But still, you've got to get people to get off their backsides and go to the game. And clearly it's absolutely happening for them, which is, they are pretty remarkable figures, I thought.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. And this has been, you know, going on for years and years. It's really smart ticketing strategy by Arsenal. They've done this over a number of years where they've gradually just increased the amount of games at the Emirates. And now they're playing, you know, all of their home games at the Emirates. And like you say, Chris, they just pack it out and they get unbelievable crowds. And the fan base is just massive as well. And it's paid off as well because those crowds are seeing quality football. You could argue that, yeah, the tickets are cheaper. However, the quality that they see on the pitch is just fantastic, and they're leading the way, and other teams are trying to follow in Arsenal's footsteps as well.
Lindsay, thanks a lot for joining us this morning.
No problem.
Thank you. That's former England international Lindsay Johnson. It's just coming up to 7:30.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
So let's get your headlines this morning. The Labour Party conference, its first in government for 15 years, is getting underway in Liverpool today. The lead up to the event has been dominated by a number of leaks from inside government. Sir Keir Starmer says they damage everybody and it's his job to do something about them.
The CPS says it twice failed to bring charges against Mohammed Al-Fayed. Fresh allegations are being made about the late billionaire, sparked by dozens of women coming forward to say they were raped or sexually assaulted by the former owner of Harrods.
Israel has imposed restrictions on civilian movements in the north of the country in case Hezbollah retaliates against its airstrikes in southern Lebanon. The authorities in Beirut say 37 people were killed on Friday in an attack on what Israel says was a Hezbollah stronghold.
And Germany's far-right AfD party could win a second regional election today in the state of Brandenburg, which surrounds Berlin. Opinion polls have shown it with a narrow lead over the centre-left Social Democratic Party of Chancellor Olaf Scholz, which has governed the state since German reunification in 1990. James Gregg is here with the sports news. Isn't it a shame when you're, you know, talking about a massive match, biggest game of the season so far, and you've got fans of both clubs coming on and going, yeah, I'm not expecting a very exciting game. Yeah. You know, you remember the old sort of Manchester United, Arsenal, those games when it, you know, and it was always tub-thumping, end-to-end, really going for its stuff, wasn't it? And I'm not bemoaning where we're at, but it's just the reality of how teams will approach going to the Etihad a lot of the time.
But if Arsenal score early, it's the whole thing will they'll either sit back. City will be, you know, it could go anyway. You know, there's no rhyme or reason.
Hey, I'll tell you
to
what.
Why games are boring or not.
That's football.
Yeah, that's football.
Hey, you never know, do you?
That's football, you know. It's just a beautiful game.
Yes.
There we go. We'll talk about more about the football actually shortly, but we must talk about the post-war record crowd for a boxing match at Wembley Stadium, and those 96,000 fans did see a cracking crescendo.
A right hand from Anthony Joshua causes Daniel Dubois to back up, and another right hand, and another right hand from Joshua, and a huge right uppercut, but during the course of an exchange, a blistering right hand has deposited Anthony Joshua on the canvas. A towel has come in from Ben Davison, and this contest is over.
Yeah, absolutely sensational commentary, that, isn't it? Daniel Dubois retaining that IBF heavyweight world title. Anthony Joshua in pieces, and Dubois had already dropped Joshua to the canvas in rounds 1, 3, and 4 before that knockout in the fifth. Amazing. Cracking fight. The boxing podcast is out now, and of course we're hearing from Buncey shortly here on the programme. We'll talk more about Arsenal's trip to Manchester City this afternoon. That is, of course, here on Five Lives Premier League Sunday at 4:30. That does feel like a very big match to say that we are still in September. In terms of yesterday's action, though, Erik ten Hag felt that his side could have been more clinical as they played out a goalless draw against Crystal Palace at Selhurst.
I think we let the opponent alive in the first half. We played some good football, but yeah, we should have been more clinical in the opponent's box. And then the second half, I think, was more in balance, more equal, and both teams could have scored a goal. Of course, we are not happy because we didn't win after such a good first half.
We ate the opponents alive. Fantastic quote that. 0-0. After two consecutive defeats, Tottenham came from behind to beat Brentford 3-1. That eased the pressure on their manager, Ange Postecoglou.
To be fair, our performances have been good all year, but today we got the result as well, which is obviously the most pleasing bit. And I said play well, probably should have won by a fair bit more, but still got the job done.
Yeah, Dom Solanke with his first goal for the club there, actually, since that £65 million move in the summer from Bournemouth. Rangers are through to the Scottish League Cup semi-final after beating Dundee 3-0. It was their first match at Ibrox this season because of the delayed renovation work they're having done there. Elsewhere, Aberdeen also 3-day beat Spartans of the fourth tier. 4-0, and Manchester United got their Women's Super League season underway with a brilliant victory over West Ham at Old Trafford. England's cricketers are 2-0 down to Australia with 3 to play after another deflating batting performance saw them lose the second ODI by 68 runs at Headingley, set 271 to win, which you did feel was a little below par. England then crumbled to 65 for 5 within the first 10 overs. They were left chasing the game from there. Here's the Aussie captain, Mitchell Marsh.
Great start. I thought it was a reasonably tricky wicket. Had a bit of everything, bit of seam, bit of spin. The way we navigated through the first sort of 10 overs of our innings was really important. Obviously, you'd always like more with the bat, but I thought the way the boys bowled was outstanding.
Britain's Lando Norris will start today's Singapore Grand Prix from pole position.
It's elation for Lando Norris, who secures pole for the Singapore Grand Prix.
It was good enough for pole, and I'm happy with that, especially here in Singapore, so... Good feeling. I felt good all weekend. I felt confident. Maybe not so much in quali, but we got the job done.
It's the McLaren driver's fourth pole in 6 races. Lewis Hamilton's third on the grid behind Verstappen. That gets underway at 1 on Sports Extra. In women's cricket, by the way, Sunrisers lifted the Rachel Hayhoe Flint Trophy for the first time. They beat Southeast Stars by 27 runs in Leicester. In rugby union's premiership, Leicester Tigers snatched a 17-14 win late on at Exeter. Saracens beat Gloucester 35-26 and Dragons have won the first Welsh derby of the new United Rugby Championship campaign. They beat Ospreys 23-21. In rugby league, Catalan already knew that they'd missed out on a top six spot, but they did end their season with a win at Hull FC 24-4. Hull FC, by the way, avoided finishing bottom of the table on points difference because of that result. And in golf, the Italian Matteo Manassero leads the European Tour's PGA Championship at Wentworth. He's on 18 under par. He's 3 strokes clear of Rory McIlroy and the American Billy Horschel. Manassero has taken the lowest 54-hole score to par in tournament history.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker to play BBC Radio 5 Live.
Did you see the storms last night? Were you in one of them? I was on the edge of one of them. I saw a bit of lightning, nothing else. Let's get the weather today with Simon King.
Good morning. It's been a pretty active few days with some pretty intense downpours and thunderstorms causing some issues. And today across England and Wales, you may be woken up this morning from some thunderstorms, particularly around some central areas of England. As we go through today across England and Wales, we're going to see some showery rain continuing on and off, and some of the showers could be heavy and thundery once again, mainly across Wales, the Midlands, Eastern and through southern areas of England. Later on today, there may well be some brighter skies developing across East Anglia and the southeast, with temperatures generally getting to about 17 to 20 Celsius. Across northern England, it's looking a little bit drier. There will be some thundery showers moving their way into parts of Merseyside, Greater Manchester, southern areas really later on this afternoon, but staying pretty cloudy in eastern parts of northeast England and across eastern and central Scotland, staying fairly cloudy today as well. But there'll be some sunshine towards northern and western Scotland, some sunny spells also developing across Northern Ireland today, and maximum temperatures 17 to 19 degrees, but around about 13 or 14 degrees right on those North Sea coasts. Simon King, 5 Live Weather.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live,
the voice of the UK.
Sunday Breakfast. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Good morning. Yes, Sunday Breakfast with Chris Warburton and Fliss Hannah. And let's turn now to the ongoing, the escalating violence in the Middle East. The Israeli military carried out what it called extensive strikes in southern Lebanon last night. This is after it said it detected Hezbollah plans to hit back at Israel. Lebanese authorities say an Israeli strike targeting Hezbollah officials in Beirut on Friday killed at least 37 people, including 3 children and 7 women. The US National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said yesterday there's a real risk that the escalation in fighting could ignite a regional war. Our correspondent in Jerusalem is Paul Adams. Paul, morning.
Good morning.
What's the latest then? What's happened overnight?
So we've had another night in which it feels that both sides are gradually upping the momentum. We had another huge wave of Israeli airstrikes into southern Lebanon. They say they targeted as many as 1,000 rocket-launching barrels. Clearly, they are intent on destroying as much of Hezbollah's rocket-firing capability as possible. But Hezbollah is showing that it is still capable of firing back, because we had at least 100 or slightly over 100 rockets fired this morning, some of which landed further into Israel than rockets previously over the past 11 months. And the Hezbollah, by Israeli estimates, have fired something in the region of 8,000 rockets already since October of last year. And some of the rockets that were fired this morning landed, as I say, further into Israel, close to the city of Haifa. We've seen images of houses on fire. We understand a car was hit, and there have been some slight injuries as well. So every sense that Hezbollah, despite the extraordinary setbacks which it has experienced over the past few days, is intent on firing back and possibly showing that it is capable of doing more than it has already.
Yeah, it's surprising in a way, isn't it, that Hezbollah are in a position to strike back so forcefully after, you know, what we've seen in the last week, and a number of their senior commanders being killed, that attack on walkie-talkies and pagers. You'd think that would have weakened them significantly.
I'm sure it has, and I'm sure the Israeli intention is to try and persuade them not to keep this up. But, you know, no one here in Israel has any illusions. Hezbollah is an extremely powerful fighting force. Hamas down in Gaza pales in comparison. Hezbollah have an astonishing arsenal of tens of thousands of rockets. Some of them are long-range, precision-guided rockets, the kinds of things that could, in a kind of worst-case scenario, target accurately the center of Israel, you know, Tel Aviv and other major cities. Now, that hasn't happened yet, and of course that is the fear, that at some point that could happen. The conventional wisdom up to now has been that Hezbollah and its Iranian backers do not have an interest in launching an all-out war, something that they probably know they would lose with, you know, with all those rockets probably being destroyed, and a good chance that chunks of southern Lebanon would be reoccupied by Israeli troops. So that's a pretty nightmarish scenario. So far there is a feeling that they want to avoid that, but they are clearly also wanting to show that despite losing a large chunk of their military leadership and the astonishing the pager and walkie-talkie explosions, which show just how penetrated their communications system is, they want to show that they are still capable of inflicting harm. And their main objective now, probably, is to keep those 60,000 Israeli civilians who have been forced to abandon their homes since the war began back in October, have the opportunity to return, something that the Israeli government has said is now one of its top priorities.
Now, I mean, you say nobody wants an all-out war. There are definitely growing concerns that might be the result. We had the UN has warned of a potential catastrophe. We've had the US National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan talking about this, you know, potentially becoming an all-out war in the Middle East. Is there a risk that it could tip into that, even if the players themselves don't want it to?
Of course. You only have to have a situation in which one of those Hezbollah rockets lands, you know, let's say on a school, and a dozen people are killed. If there is a significant cost in human lives on this side of the border, then there's every prospect that Israel will take even more dramatic action in return. There was a suggestion this morning that there's an element of coordination, because in addition to the Hezbollah rockets, there are reports that some missiles were fired from Iraq to the east and also from Yemen in the south, suggesting a degree of coordination among the various Iranian-backed opponents of Israel. All of this, of course, could escalate at any time, and there have been several moments over the past 11 months when such an escalation seemed possible. This probably feels like one of the more dangerous moments so far, because there is talk of Israel following up these attacks with some kind of ground operation in southern Lebanon designed to create perhaps temporarily some kind of buffer zone along the northern border. If that were to happen, then of course we would be in yet another new situation. At the moment, we are teetering on the edge of a kind of rules of the game that have prevailed for the last 11 months being stretched and perhaps broken decisively. But we're not quite there yet.
Paul Adams, thank you very much indeed. That's Paul Adams for us in Jerusalem. And after 8:30, I'll be speaking to a Lebanese journalist in Beirut. After 9:30, we've got a military expert at Bar Ilan University in Israel. Stay with us. It is just coming up to 8:15.
Five Live Premier League Sunday.
Mikel Arteta to Arsenal is confirmed.
We were sad when he leaves. He's a ball for beyond a good manager.
Arsenal have confirmed the signing of Declan Rice.
Manchester City have agreed a deal to sign Erling Haaland.
Champions again. They've won it 4 years running.
I think Arsenal get even closer again.
Their level is higher and higher.
Five Live Premier League Sunday.
Welcome to you, Manchester City against Arsenal.
Listen today from 12 on Five Live and BBC Sounds.
Yeah, live commentary of that. We had live commentary of the boxing last night. It's boxing time. It's bunts time. Folks, Daniel Dubois sensationally dismantling Anthony Joshua in five rounds at Wembley Stadium last night. Yeah, so he retains the IBF heavyweight title and really leaves his domestic rival's career in ruins.
Daniel Dubois reaches and lands the right hand once again, and he dips to the knees of Anthony Joshua. AJ holding his chin up like a weather vane. Oh, counter right uppercut. The left hook buckled the knees of Anthony Joshua, and he's down for the second time. Referee Marcus McDonald allows the action to continue as Joshua gets back up to his feet, but he's punched down to the canvas. So the bell sounds to begin round number four, and Daniel Dubois lands a left hook which deposits Anthony Joshua on the canvas for the third time in the contest. Anthony Joshua back into the breach, and he's in desperate trouble as Dubois barrels him over to the canvas once again. And Anthony Joshua moving as though he is wading through wet concrete. His feet appear leaden, his hands appear painfully slow. More clumping blows landing on the gloves and forearms of Anthony Joshua. And Anthony Joshua in the midst of a nightmare here at the National Stadium. And then a right hand from Anthony Joshua causes Daniel Dubois to back up. And another right hand. And another right hand from Joshua. And a huge right uppercut. But during the course of an exchange, a blistering right hand has deposited Anthony Joshua on the canvas. The towel has come in, and this contest is over.
Well, there you go. And the music you could hear Liam Gallagher actually singing before the fight. Make your own judgment on that. Steve Bunce is here. Morning, Steve.
Morning, team. I'm not quite sure, having listened to that back, I'm not quite sure where to start, because you know, I come on here too many mornings, Chris and Fliss, and I tell you how great the night was before. I've been doing it for too many years, and I don't mean, don't want to sound like an old man, don't want to give me age away. But you know what? I'm coming on here this morning almost, I feel like it's a unique one, what we witnessed last night from the entire week. You know the story, you know the itinerary. And then a four knockdown, five round brawl in front of 96,000 people, ending with the most perfect counter right hand. And a man called AJ, the darling, the love, the man that's driven and carried British boxing since that summer 2012 gold medal victory, on the floor, struggling to get up. I'll tell you what, if you want nightmares, okay, and you feel your life's too good, just watch Anthony Joshua in slow motion trying to beat the count. That is the thing of permanent nightmares.
Ronald said it, didn't he? Joshua in the midst of a nightmare. That was before the final knockdown.
That's the truth.
That was the truth, wasn't it? Where does he go next, AJ?
Well, he's talking to me. I managed to get a little exclusive walk and talk with him, which will stick on the pod. Mm. And he looked at me when I said, could this be the end, AJ? And he said, no, man, I'm a fighter for life. And then Eddie Hearn chipped in with, there is a rematch clause. We're going to let the dust settle, said Eddie Hearn. We're going to let Daniel Dubois have his moment. And then that will probably be invoked. So there could be... listen, I can't believe I'm sitting here at 7:48, just a few hours after arriving back from Wembley, telling you we might see a rematch.
But why would he? Well, I mean, obviously it's a payday, but he was knocked about so badly, Steve. I mean, has he got another gear in him these days?
Well, I'm not sure he's got another gear in him, but he needs to show it to himself, and he will want to do that. He did it before, Chris. You remember when Andy Ruiz, the little Mexican guy in Madison Square Garden, 19,000 people there, bang, all over, completely against the run of the fight. He had 6 or 7 months off, went to Saudi Arabia, boxed Andy Ruiz's ears off. He'll be thinking he can do the same thing. The problem was, that was about 5 years ago.
That's the thing, isn't
it? And he's now 34 and he's had a lot of hard fights. Do you know he had 12 consecutive world title fights? Last night was his 13th world title fight. He's been in the spotlight since he turned professional. Pressure that no other British boxers ever had. Me personally, if he walked away, I'd raise whatever was close and I'd sup it down. And I really mean that.
Daniel Dubois, he's not the most sort of mouthy of boxers, is he? But have a little this. We've got 9 seconds of his reaction. Here we are.
No, I'm a gladiator, I'm just a warrior to the end, to the bitter end, and I'm just ready to go. You know, I want to go to the top level of this game and reach my full potential.
He's a hard man, Steve. He's a big man, and I wonder what Tyson Fury and Alexander Usyk were thinking when they were watching from the side at that performance.
Well, Fury looked sickened, if you want my honest opinion. The big lad was there in his shorts and his smiles and shaking everybody's hands. And when it is over, he looks slightly sickened. And that's because I think Fury and AJ, even though they've gone at each other and they've been meant to fight for about 6 years now, I think they've got a soft spot for each other, and I really do. And Fury looks slightly sickened. He likes Daniel. He's been around Daniel. He's had Daniel in camp over the years. He looks slightly sickened. Alexander Usyk looks shocked, not in a bad way, because Alexander Usyk beat Daniel Dubois last year in front of 50,000 people in Poland. It was quite a hard fight for a couple of rounds. Then Dubois suddenly started to fall apart and Usyk took over. So he was looking at it as if to say, that's a fighter I didn't know was around last year, because that wasn't. The Daniel Dubois in the ring last night was not the fighter that the Daniel Dubois before. There were a couple of black marks, asterisks, if you like, attached to Daniel Dubois' career. One was in 2020 against a man called Joe Joyce. When with his eye completely closing, he backed off, took a knee and turned away. Well, that raises flags in our boxing business, which is a brutal and heartless business. Let's get that right. And that raises flags there. So that's been something that's been hanging over Daniel. He exercised the demons of quitting in that fight last year and this year in two fights as an underdog in Saudi Arabia to set up what we witnessed last night. And Daniel Dubois has been saying all week, it's been his favourite word, not warrior, none of that rubbish, that's all soundbite stuff. Mm. He's been saying all week, this is about redemption, this is about my redemption. Well, I tell you what, they don't build belts for redemption. If they did, he'd have a giant one round his waist this morning.
Does a night like that do anything at all around the balance of where these big fights are held, Steve?
Well, obviously, what you're talking about there is the fact it was part of what we call Riyadh season, which seems to run for, 12 months of the year, to be perfectly honest with you. We've had some fantastic Riyadh season fights out in Saudi Arabia. Of course, that's where you'd imagine there'll be Riyadh season, the clue's in the name. This was the first one in London, and the man in charge of it, Turki Alashaykh, he's the guy that's kind of led this revolution, this boxing revolution, putting on all these incredible fights. Last night, I think, was the 56th fight in the series of, I think it's 7 nights that we've had. What it did last night is it showed that the crowds in London, and it is London, trust me, you can't get that night anywhere else in the world. You can't get 96,000 people holding up their wristbands like they're at a Coldplay gig. Or that's what it was like.
Different vibe.
But listen, then Liam came out and he was in fine voice. Well, so I'm told the acoustics were dire. I couldn't hear a thing. I just saw him with showing plenty of swag and throwing maracas into the crowd. What more do you want from Liam Gallagher in front of 96,000 people?
I just had a question from a listener here. It sort of feeds into what we're talking about. I might as well put it to you. What I can't fathom in heavyweight boxing now is, where are the Americans lately? They used to dominate the weight division.
You know what? The Americans have vanished. Every now and again, one pops up. We had Deontay Wilder, you know, that a ridiculously powerful guy, nice guy. Well, he's been smashed to bits a couple of times. Then we had a guy called Jared Anderson, and they were building, they were gearing towards the top, but he was a created guy. He'd switched over from American football. Good-looking young kid. He recently got smashed to bits by a guy called Martin Bacoli. They've got no one. Don King famously said to me in about 2005, as Donnie was only, he was only about 87 years of age at the time, he said the richest man in the world would be the promoter that can find an American heavyweight. And I tell you what, he's absolutely right. The race is on. The search is on. There's a couple of different promotional production companies in America literally advertising. You know, are you above 6'5"? Are you between 18 and 24? Do you like getting hit in the face? Would you like to make a million? No, you think I'm kidding. Yeah, no, they're out there. The auditions are happening, Chris. I'm not winding you up.
No, I just love the phrasing of it, Steve. It's classic. All right, good stuff, mate. Thanks a lot. Really good to talk to you.
It's my pleasure. See you at the pair of you later. Thank you.
Take care of yourself. Cheers. Steve Bunce, we'll have more reaction to the fight a little bit later on in the programme. Right, 5 minutes to 8 now.
Yeah, and I don't know if you can get any further removed from the boxing and the crowds and the glamour and the Oasis, you know, than the next story, which has a sort of quiet, calm dignity. Tomorrow is the 50th anniversary of CFAX, the world's first teletext service. This was, of course, the groundbreaking precursor to the internet. It was the internet before the internet was cool. It was the first time, really, we had information on demand for the masses. Let's talk to Ian Westbrook, who was the final ever CFAX sports editor. Joins us now. Ian, morning.
Hi, good morning.
How do people react? Do you talk about your time at CFAX? Do people have fond memories?
I definitely do. I mean, it was a place when you worked there. You said, I work for CFAX Sport. Everybody knew what you did. Oh, I use that. I get my football scores there. I get the news there. It was a fantastic place to work. It was my dream job. As a kid, I used to use it for football news, and to actually work there for so many years was tremendous.
What was it like when it came to an end? That's what, 2012. And do you think by that point people were just, you know, they could get the sports online? You know, they had the red button. That, you know, they'd kind of moved on with where they could get that on demand information.
I think it was a really sad day because CFAX was still there. There was a team from 2004, one team produced pages for CFAX and the Red Button and the sport website all at the same time. So the content was going to all these different places. But CFAX was loved by people. Younger people weren't always talking about my children themselves and never saw it. But for a lot of people, it was the only way to find out your, say, for example, your team's latest football score on a Saturday afternoon was to see it on CFAX.
I mean, it's almost like you could almost ID people coming into a pub, couldn't you, by asking them to identify CFAX? Do you talk about kids? Do you find that there's just that generational divide?
Definitely, definitely. I mean, you know, you talk to young people in their 20s, and they can't imagine, excuse me, not being able to suddenly call it information wherever they want it. But back, you know, when I was in the 70s, if you missed, say, the football results, we read out at 5 o'clock on the radio. That was it till the next day, and if you bought your Saturday evening paper. So CFAX was there. It meant it was the first, as you said, on-demand news service. You'd look up the news headlines or the football scores or what the weather was going to be. Midnight, if you wanted to, or 3 in the morning or 3 in the afternoon, which you couldn't do before.
And I think the only thing I really remember from CFAX was, like, pages of holiday information with, like, they'd be really inventive with, like, the graphics is a strong word, but yeah, I can remember there being like a palm tree kind of made out of the CFAX blockiness. Do you think the limits of it gave it its charm?
I'd say that the holiday adverts were actually our rivals on ITV on teletext.
I'm just getting confused.
That's right. But yeah, I mean, it was a simple design. It was very simple. It was nothing sort of flashy about it. Although it did have its days. It had its graphics back in the day. One year, the boat race was covered live on CFAX for graphics of the boats going across the screen. So, you know, for the medium that it was, a lot of creativity did go into it.
Are there pages that are just, like, it's just part of your brain, like burned into your psyche, like you know which page was which bit of information?
Absolutely. So the sport headlines were on 301, the football index 302, cricket index 340.
Chris Warburton just nodding along.
I can remember all of these numbers, particularly for the sport. Yeah, absolutely. I was remembering there was a, hang on, this was teletext as well, actually. There was a soap opera on Oracle. Do you remember this? ITV's service. It was called Park Avenue. Looking it up online. I mean, that's completely mad, isn't it? Every day someone was writing this soap opera for Teletext.
Yeah, it existed.
Yeah, the other side. Yeah, fair enough.
The strength of it, CFAX, was so, unique in its way. I remember working at the World Snooker Championship in the press room covering snooker for CFAX on a Saturday afternoon. The players would stand behind our desk. It was the only way they could get the latest football scores. No other source doing it. So it was powerful in its day.
That's brilliant.
The absolute power of CFAX. Ian, fantastic to talk to you. The final ever CFAX sports editor.
That's it, yeah. I'm proud to have that title.
It's a good title. Ian Westbrook there. Thank you very much for being with us. I just feel like I missed out on CFAX. I remember it existing, but I don't remember using it.
Yeah, I remember using it pretty religiously, I have to say, for the sports results. It was always there.
And the soap operas.
I sort of get the feeling that Ian's still not a huge fan of Teletext, the other side. Do you know what I mean? That was pretty evident, wasn't it? We're coming up to 8 o'clock. We're going to look ahead to Arsenal against Manchester City, which is obviously the big match this afternoon, 4:30. We'll have live coverage, live commentary of, it's not title decided yet, is it? But it's the biggest game of the season so far, so we'll get into that. But we're coming up to the news at 8 o'clock.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Yeah, it's Felicity Hannah and Chris Warburton with you this morning on 5 Live Sunday Breakfast. And the headline, Sir Keir Starmer says it's his job to do something about leaks from his government. A number of Whitehall sources told the BBC earlier this week that his top adviser, Sue Gray, was paid more than him amid signs of disquiet in his top ranks. The Prime Minister spoke ahead of Labour's first party conference in government in 15 years. John McTernan was Tony Blair's Director of Political Operations from 2005 to 2007.
In a sense, people are right to think things are difficult. The job this week of Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves and the rest of the cabinet is not to celebrate, but to say, this is what we're going to do for you. Yes, you have to be realistic with the public, saying things are going to get worse before they get better, but you have to be visionary and optimistic and say, and this is what better looks like.
The Israeli military says Hezbollah has fired a barrage of rockets from Lebanon. The Iranian-backed group says the attacks were an initial response to the wave of explosions of pagers and walkie-talkies that's widely believed to have been carried out by Israel. Our correspondent Paul Adams reports from Jerusalem.
Hezbollah is doing its best to demonstrate that it's still a formidable opponent. This morning, sirens sounded over large parts of northern Israel and more than 100 rockets were fired across the border. The army said some were intercepted, but there have been reports of Hezbollah rockets landing much further into Israel than before, close to the port city of Haifa and further east in the Galilee. Houses have been hit and people injured. Hezbollah said the targets included an Israeli defense technology company and an airbase. Last night, the authorities ordered schools in the north to close and restricted public gatherings in many areas.
Germany's far-right Alternative for Deutschland, or AfD party, could win a second regional election today in the state of Brandenburg, which surrounds Berlin. Opinion polls have shown it with a narrow lead over the centre-left Social Democratic Party of Chancellor Olaf Scholz, which has governed the state since German reunification in 1990.
The Princess Royal will join veterans and members of the armed forces.